Welcome to the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast. Every 2 weeks, we explore news and issues affecting hunters, anglers, and conservation across the northeastern United States. If you enjoy the content here, be sure to subscribe to our print or digital versions by calling 800-535-5191 or visit our website at outdoornews.com. Now, here's your host and a man who claims he's immune to buck fever, New York Outdoor News editor Dan Ladd. New York Outdoor News is the most timely and reliable source for hunting, fishing, and conservation news in the Empire State. 26 times per year, we'll drop our print edition directly into your mailbox, or you can access our digital content via your laptop, tablet, or smartphone. Annual print or digital subscriptions start at just $30. The state's best fishing reports, the latest news from the DEC, and top hunting and fishing tips. To subscribe, visit outdoornews.com/New York.
Welcome to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News, and it probably doesn't get any more summery than it can be down on Long Island right now. And we've got with us Charles Wittick. He is involved with a lot of things with saltwater fishing, the marine industry down there on the island. Charles, how you doing today?
I'm doing real well, Dan.
Great to have you along. Charles, I have a habit of calling him Charlie because we do know each other, but we through the New York State Outdoor Writers Association, and I've been down on Long Island with Charles and toured some of the wineries, but when we start talking about all things fishing, Charles can get pretty serious. So Charles, tell us a little bit about some of the things you're involved in down there, especially, you know, with marine saltwater fishing.
Okay. I'm an active saltwater angler. I have been all my life. I run a boat out of Fire Island Inlet. I keep it in Babylon, New York. I sit on New York's Marine Resources Advisory Council, which advises the Department of Environmental Conservation on fisheries management, proposed regulations, proposed legislation, and that type of thing. I also do something that I really enjoy in that I help the Stony Brook University shark research team. We're out and we go out and we acoustic tag coastal sharks. And when we talk about coastal sharks, we're talking about some fish that, you know, can get fairly large. We get common threshers, we get sandbars, we get duskies. And I was out last Saturday and we actually got two white sharks on the same day, which is something I've never done before.
You had an article about that a few years ago, which was really interesting. I remember you writing about that. We had a few pictures and you were taking the students out, you know, in your boat, correct?
Yes. I take them out on my boat because I have all the equipment and I'm comfortable with the boat and I know how to fish it well.
So you sit with on this council with DEC. I know there's a lot going on. We're going to get into this shark thing pretty heavy here, but so this involves all the things such as the striped bass regulations, the shell fishing restrictions we commonly see come through in the press releases from DEC. And I ask this because I'm very far removed from saltwater and marine. And so I'm asking you as someone who's knowledgeable of this, that all plays into these decisions that DEC makes regarding, you know, again, the shell fishing seasons that I often see, our striped bass regulations. And I know there's, at the bigger picture, there's federal input here. So I guess my question is, what is the agency's role and how does that fit with what you're doing, you know, as a volunteer?
Okay, the Marine Resources Advisory Council is made up of 7 members from the commercial fishing industry and 7 members from the recreational fishing community, and is chaired by someone from the Stony Brook University School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. they are by statute required to give input on any proposed regulations that the DEC is considering putting in place. And if the DEC decides not to take the council's advice, it actually has to put written notice of why it did not take that advice when it issues the regulations. So the council does have a fairly material impact on the regulations that come out. They're everything from shellfish to striped bass. There's actually a shark regulation being considered right now. But the DEC's authority is everything within 3 miles of shore. That's state waters. Beyond that is the federal jurisdiction.
I did not know that. That's good information. So DEC does have something at stake here. And that's I think, for people outside of, say, you know, the marine area that you're in, the saltwater region, so to speak, that's probably something that they don't understand. Do you know if it's similar like that in other states, you know, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Massachusetts? Is it the same thing? They have that jurisdiction 3 miles out?
Yes. Federal waters begin 3 miles from shore. There's a few local exceptions, but generally 3 miles from shore. And by statute, by federal statute, federal fisheries managers have virtually no authority in state waters. They only have authority managing in 3 miles out unless you're things like a federally licensed charter boat, at which point you must always follow federal regs. But otherwise, state regulations govern within 3 miles.
Well, let's get into this shark regulation, proposed regulation, I should say, because I know there's a debate on it. And that 3 mile jurisdiction basically stirs a question in me, because we've had some input from this, as you know, from readers. You've been covering this for us in New York Outdoor News. And so this new regulation applies to shore anglers and not so much boat anglers. Is that because it's a state regulation and not a federal regulation?
That's part of the reason. The other reason is that the shore anglers have a disproportionate impact on what we call prohibited species. Those are species that may not be retained if you catch them and may not even be intentionally targeted. Most of the sharks, not all of the sharks, but most of the sharks that are caught by shore-based shark anglers are either sandbar sharks, which other people call brown sharks, or sand tiger sharks, both of which are prohibited species.
And they're actually catching them when they're surf casting.
They're catching them, and the reality is they're targeting them, which is also illegal.
When we talk about this regulation, again, I'm not connected to this, so I'm asking you as someone who is knowledgeable. These regulations have to do with leader length. Is there hook regulations involved here?
Yes. Yeah. What it is you can't use a hook over a certain size. If I remember correctly, a J hook can't be more than an inch across the gap. And the circle hook, I think, is an inch and an eighth or an inch and a quarter. The idea is not allowing people to use hooks large enough to be effective shark hooks.
Well, I know they went with circle hooks for striped bass, and that's really helped some of the mortality, correct?
Not exactly.
Oh, okay.
They were intended to help with the mortality, but there are some studies that are going on now that suggest, because the way the striped bass feeds, that the circle hooks may not be as effective as they hoped they were.
Okay.
That, you know, striped bass, they more or less inhale their food. So they'll pick up a chunk and they'll suction feed. And that'll take the bait deep where even a circle hook can hang up in the gills. Circle hooks are less likely to cause serious mortality in striped bass, but they're not quite as effective as they originally hoped.
Let's get back to the sharks here and shore fishing. I know shore fishing is big down there. Angelo Peluso, who writes for us, does a lot of shore fishing. And, you know, we hear a lot about it, and especially for striped bass off of places like Montauk Point. And again, I'm just going by things I've read, things I've heard, things our writers have shared. And so I hear a lot about shore fishing down there. Are these gripes that some of the shore anglers have about these proposals, are they legit? For example, I think the gentleman who wrote a letter for us, he said that, you know, some of the bait shops have a lot of this stuff on their shelves right now. And if this regulation was put in place, it could be a financial thing for them. And, you know, does this all make sense? Are these arguments legitimate?
Well, certainly the person on the Marine Resources Advisory Council who represents the bait shops has said that if this goes in quickly, that shops would be caught with a lot of unsaleable inventory. The thing to remember is the shark reg will not go into effect until 2024 just because of the delays in the regulatory process. So that will give them a chance to offload some inventory. And of course, they can still sell those hooks to boat fishermen.
Are there other states that are dealing with this? And if so, how are they dealing with it? And Florida is the one that comes to mind.
Just about all the states on the coast are starting to deal with it. Florida is a little bit different because they have a different species mix. A lot of the sharks that are being caught in Florida are not prohibited species. They're getting black tips, they're getting spinners, they're getting hammerheads, they're getting lemons, they're getting bulls, all of which are authorized for capture. So Florida is not directly analogous to New York when you talk about shore-based shark fishing. In addition, there is a question as to what the intent of the regulations are. I would have to say that the intent of the New York regs are to discourage people from targeting sharks from shore, which is not necessarily the case in Florida because, again, Florida has a different species mix and prohibited species are not as much a part of the scene.
Let's hold that thought on a species. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with more shark and striped bass talk and maybe even some turkeys down there on Long Island with Charles Wittick right after this.
If you know a kid who loves to hunt and fish, tell them to check out the Outdoor News Junior Pro Team. The Junior Pro Team is about becoming a pro and sharing your photos, videos, and tips. There's members-only discounts. Plus, members can win gear with our weekly drawings. Membership to the Junior Pro Team is free, and kids get a decal, window cling, and membership card when they join. Check out the Outdoor News Junior Pro Team on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and join the team online at juniorproteam.com.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News, and we've got a great summer topic because it's probably no more summer like anywhere in New York right now than it is down on Long Island. If you've ever been down there in the summer, it's an extremely popular place this time of year. And with us is a diehard saltwater fisherman, Charles Wittick. He's also one of our writers with New York Outdoor News, and we've been talking about sharks. And Charles, I want to continue that discussion because there's obviously a lot of different species of sharks. And as you stated, some are more sensitive than others. And the proposals that DEC is putting forth to protect sharks is, especially where shore fishing concerned, I guess, has to do with protecting more sensitive species.
It's species that are either overfished or have a reproductive strategy that makes them very vulnerable to overfishing. For example, the sandbar shark, the brown shark, probably won't recover and have a population fully rebuilt for decades. The dusky shark, which is another shark that's sometimes caught from shore, the shortest rebuilding time for its population is 80 years, and some have estimated it could take 400 years for the population to restore itself.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Okay.
And that's why they need protection. You know, they mature very late in life. They don't reproduce quickly. Most of them produce live young. And it takes a very long time for the population to increase, but it can be knocked down very quickly.
Now, again, I'm the greenhorn here when it comes to this stuff. You've got shore fishing going on and you've got boat fishing going on. How do they differ? Because I hear, for example, Mike Dean, who writes our fishing reports, he just caught, I believe, a brown shark. He wasn't targeting it and it just took his bait. I've also heard that the sharks often, if you catch a certain species of fish while you're bringing that in, the sharks are stealing it. But so anyways, when they get caught on a boat versus being caught on shore, Is there any difference in, say, the mortality or the damage they suffer, you know, from being caught?
It's much easier to safely release a shark from a boat. You can bring it up to the boat. It's fully supported by the water. One person holds the leader. The other person can either reach down with a pair of pliers and cut the leader right next to the hook, or do what I do now is use a pair of bolt cutters to cut through the hook itself so there's nothing left in the fish. When you're shore fishing for sharks, obviously you have the surf as a problem. Many people pull the fish up so that it's resting on the bottom, and many pull it right up onto the sand. And now you have a fish that has no bones. Remember that sharks are what we call a cartilaginous fish. Its body is made up of cartilage, not bone. And it's very difficult for that body to support the weight of the fish out of water. So the shark's internal organs are being potentially damaged. And of course, if you try to move the shark on the beach, most people pull it by its tail, and that you have a real risk of damaging the spinal column. That's why the new regulations are going to require in-water release and require anyone who does intentionally fish for sharks to use bolt cutters or wire cutters.
Okay.
Because, and then it's not, doesn't help that a lot of the shore-based shark fishing is done for Instagram and Facebook likes. People sit on the fish, they grab them by the nose and pull the head back to show off the teeth. They do all that sort of thing, which again causes crippling, if not fatal, damage to the fish.
So it's obvious you support these regulations as proposed.
Yes, I do. I have qualms about only one of them, which is the restriction on the use of artificial lures, only because prohibited species don't strike them. But what I've learned is it's a law enforcement issue, that they're afraid someone will take an artificial lure, hang a piece of bait on it, and get around the circle hook requirement. Yes, I support the regulations as written.
Again, how does this affect the industry? I mean, I'm going back to the bait shops here. If these go forth, how can they adapt?
It's actually not going to hurt the industry from a shark perspective as much as it is potentially from a bluefish and striped bass perspective, because many surf fishermen for blues and bass use larger hooks than those required. But the answer is they're going to have to just downsize the gear that they sell.
And a big question that we ask, I guess, anytime there's a proposed regulation, we talk about lead ammunition on state lands. Is this enforceable?
Well, these regulations were drafted with very close consultation with the DEC law enforcement. That's why they're written the way they are. It's not you can't fish for sharks without a hook of larger than X. It's that you can't use a hook larger than a certain size. So people can't say, hey, I'm not shark fishing, I'm striped bass fishing. They are general restrictions to make enforceability as easy as possible.
So there's some public input opportunities here regarding this, whether people agree with you or disagree with you or whatever, you know, whatever their feelings are, there's a public forum here. I believe the public comment period runs through August 7th, but there's also a virtual public meeting scheduled for August 1st, correct? Will you be part of that?
That's correct. I probably won't be. I issued written regulations. I'm commenting at the Marine Resources Advisory Council, so I will probably not be on the webinar, though I may tune in just to listen.
Okay. And how do you think that's going to go? Do you think there's going to be a lot of support for, against? Do you think you're going to hear evenly from people who agree or disagree with these proposals or parts of them?
I actually expect a lot of opposition. Mm-hmm. I think the striped bass fishermen, the blue fishermen are going to complain that the regulations don't let them use hooks large enough to be effective with certain baits. I think that they'll complain about the 12-inch wire leader restriction. I don't think you're going to hear too much from the shark fishermen. The shark fishermen on Long Island, the shore-bound shark fishermen, generally fall into two categories. One category are the people who just enjoy it and do it very quietly, trying not to be noticed because they don't want to upset anyone. And the other category, as I mentioned, are the Facebook, Instagram types. And they tend to do it for show when they're not the type that tend to call into hearings.
So these regulations, just to summarize, are for all shore anglers, no matter what species they're targeting. But the design behind them is to protect sharks.
The hook and leader requirements, yes. That was what you raised before, was the enforceability issue. So that's why it's written that way. There are shark specific regulations. You know, you can't use a drone to take your bait out. You have to have bolt cutters with you, that type of thing. You have to release the fish in the water. But outside of that, it applies to everyone.
We'll be right back with more with Charles Wittick right after this.
Introducing the all-new OutdoorNews.com, the most trusted source for all things out of doors in the Great Lakes region, just got better. At OutdoorNews.com, you'll now have full access to every outdoor news story, breaking news and updates, our comprehensive fishing and hunting reports, pro tips, and much more for our seven-state region and beyond. Top hunters and anglers look to Outdoor News to keep them up to date and ahead of the crowd. Now it's easier than ever with the all-new OutdoorNews.com.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News. We've got Charles Wittick from down on Long Island with us. We've been talking about some proposed regulations for shore fishermen down there that mainly are designed to protect sharks, but will impact other folks who maybe fish for striped bass. We want to talk about stripers with you, Charles, but I got one more shark question for you, and that is how far some of these species go up the coast. And one of the things a gentleman who wrote a letter for us mentioned is that with, you know, warming waters, that they're seeing different species of sharks. So is this something we can see maybe going up the coast to Massachusetts, Maine, you know, up in that part of the Northeast?
Certainly. Sandbar sharks, for example, are frequently caught off Massachusetts. And although they're not frequently encountered from shore, white sharks go all the way up into Canadian waters. On the other hand, down here in New York, we're seeing fish that we almost never saw before. We're seeing black tips and spinners, which normally didn't come much further north than Delaware Bay. We're seeing schools of them ripping through Menhaden schools right off Fire Island. So there's definitely a movement of shark species due to warming waters.
Let's move on to striped bass. I know we've got some proposed, well, they're not proposals anymore. They've recently enacted some changes, and I know you were probably part of that process. What's your input on that? And if you can highlight them a little bit, that would be great.
Okay. And I have to tell you, we have the emergency regulations that went into effect, but there is going to be more on the way. Because striped bass are in fairly serious trouble right now. It doesn't look like it. Fish are abundant. There was a huge 2015 year class produced down in Maryland. Everybody's catching 2015s along the coast. Those are fish that are in the low 10 pounds, low teens right now. There were some other big year classes that are providing good fishing. But there has been basically spawning failure down in Maryland since 2019. There is a huge hole in the age structure of the population, and we're going to be noting it more and more as those fish get older, and the big fish we're catching now age out of the population, and no younger fish come in to take their place. We have to remember striped bass are already technically overfished, which means the population is too small to sustain it in the long term. And it is supposed to be rebuilt by 2029 under the terms of the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission's Striped Bass Management Plan. It is doubtful whether that is going to happen unless some really meaningful changes occur. Right now, we're fishing more than the target mortality rate. Even if we got fishing mortality down to target, which a new management effort, which will go into place hopefully at the beginning of next year, will do, there will still only be a 28% chance of rebuilding the population by 2029. So we can expect that maybe in 2025, we're going to see even more restrictive regulations coming down the road.
What's your message to striped bass fishermen, and how does it differ, you know, coastal versus, say, what I'm used to seeing is, you know, the Hudson River?
Okay, my message to bass fishermen is get behind the regulations, get behind the fisheries managers, because what we don't want to see is a repeat of what we saw in the early 1980s when the stock collapsed and it was almost impossible to find bass along most of the coast. I was fishing back then. I was very actively bass fishing back then. And right now looks frighteningly close to what 1978 looked like, where there were an abundance of larger fish, but the smaller fish were disappearing, and it was just a matter of time until the stock collapsed. We can still prevent that from happening if we put the proper regulations in place. You know, yes, the regulations are going to be a little bit burdensome, but I can tell any angler out there, having been through it, they do not want to see a stock collapse, because there's a difference between not being able to take a bass home because of regulations and not being able to catch a bass because they effectively don't exist on your section of coast. How that affects the Hudson versus the rest of the coast? Well, Maryland is the most important producer of striped bass on the coast. Depending on the year, anywhere between 60 and 90% of the bass on the coast come from Chesapeake Bay. The Hudson is a secondary producer. It's the second most important producer of striped bass. During the last stock collapse, we had relatively better fishing around the New York Bight, out to Montauk, down into New Jersey, because we benefited from the Hudson stock when the Maryland fish disappeared. But the Hudson fish will not take up anywhere close to all of the slack. And there's no guarantee that Hudson production is going to stay high either. In fact, if you look at the charts going back to the 1990 or so, you'll notice that overall a trend is slightly downward.
What about other rivers in the Northeast, like the Delaware or even the Connecticut? Does the Connecticut River have a striped bass run?
If it has a run, but it probably does not maintain a spawning stock. If it does, the production is trivial. The last time I spoke to someone from Connecticut, they did not believe there was a spawning stock there. Delaware is the third most important producer on the Atlantic coast, but again, it's less of a population than the Hudson produces, and we will not see anywhere near as many fish as come out of, you know, Chesapeake Bay.
Well, let's move on. Let's wrap this up with some turkey talk. You're just coming off the first May spring turkey season down there on Long Island, and I know you had some fun. I know you didn't get a bird, but I know you got out and enjoyed it. And what's the overall consensus of that among the local folks down there? And as well, if you've heard any, you know, input from DEC on this.
I think it was a very successful hunt. I'm not hearing any real complaints. The biggest complaints I'm hearing is, well, we couldn't get out enough. And I guess that's going to happen when you have limited space and a lot of hunters. But the DEC managed the properties very well. I was able to get out four times. I could have gotten out more often if I had the time to get out. Because even though you had to reserve a spot in advance, they had a program where you could get unreserved properties by calling in a week ahead of time. I never failed to get a spot when I tried to do that. It was a safe hunt. The way they ran it and the reservations kept people generally far enough apart that you did not run into other hunters. And there were some beautiful birds taken. I think the largest one I heard of was 26 pounds.
Yeah, I would expect that there would be some nice gobblers the first time around. One of the things we talk about up here in the Adirondacks, and this is a pipe dream, but if we ever were to have a moose hunting season, those first couple of years, there would probably be some incredible bulls being taken. What's the level of hunter experience down there? Is there a lot of folks that just tried turkey hunting for the first time?
There were some, but there were a lot of people who typically hunt upstate, and instead of going up to the Catskills, they hunted locally when they could. They still went upstate when they had the opportunities, but this gave them another outlet for their turkey hunting.
Well, Charles, I appreciate you coming on and talking with us. Hope you'll keep us informed on how things shake out with these shark regulations and any input you hear. And I'm sure we'll be having some more coverage on that, as well as the striped bass future proposals you mentioned. It's been great having you on. We wish you and your wife, Teresa, the best. And once again, we've had Charles Wittick from Long Island with us talking about saltwater and marine and all the things that are going on down there on Long Island and beyond. And it's been quite a conversation. Folks, we hope you get a chance to get out and enjoy the summer, maybe do some fishing of some sort. And it won't be long. We're starting to get ready for deer season as well. So here's hoping you have a fish in your net and a big buck on your meat pole. Until the next time, for New York Outdoor News and the Great Northeast Podcast, I'm Dan Ladd.
Missed a past episode of the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast? You can find previous programs at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platform. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover on this program, get yourself a subscription to Outdoor News. Simply call 800-535-5191 or visit us at OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us again here in 2 weeks to talk everything out of doors. Thanks for listening to the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast.